I'd like to do what Ian did yesterday, which is to ask for God's blessing on our time together. So, Father, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. All right, now we need, or let me try, see if I can make sure that this, come on. Hallelujah. Okay. My talk is entitled Faith, Science, and Service on Capitol Hill. And all of those three things can indeed go together, as I'm discovering through the fellowship that I am now enjoying in Washington, D.C. Sarah told you a little bit about my background, and it is true that I grew up in rural Arkansas, where you could think about a lot of things about nature and science at the same time. I grew up on a cattle ranch, a small one, so I could think about animals and agriculture and stars all at the same time by just looking around me. So it did cause me to have a sense of wonder and also a desire of exploration. I always loved the idea of space exploration. So when I went to college, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do with that, but I went ahead and majored in physics because I think physics is a really basic science that you can use to in any field. And I went on in to study professional astronomy in a town where you can't see the stars, ironically, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But I have enjoyed years of interesting research, for which I'm grateful, but I was getting a little bit tired of it in some sense. And I was sort of asking the Lord, you know, is this all there is? You know, is there some other, how many of you have ever wished that maybe you could do something very different for a while? Anybody out there? So I sort of, you know, was at the position where I had to kind of choose whether to keep going on this academic track, which I may well continue to do for the long run, or try something exotic, and I just cried out to the Lord for some kind of change, and the Lord answered my cry with a fire hose by giving me this fantastic and unusual position on Capitol Hill. So, one thing we're always warned not to talk about in polite company, if you want to maintain your friends, are what, you know what they are, religion and politics, right? So today I'm going to discuss religion and politics, and I hope we don't all leave on a bad note from this meeting, so we'll see. Science plays a role in nearly every issue that's considered by Congress. If you think about it, there's hardly anything that doesn't have a scientific component. That's discussions of basic research, national security, the economy, international relations, our environment, agriculture policy, education, you know, you could add 100 more topics to the list, but everything involves a scientific component, and everything that our lawmakers are looking at have, you know, most of it has some kind of science component. Now, add that to the next little bullet here. I didn't actually make it on a bullet, but on a future slide, it will tell you that most scientists do not have any or very much science or technical background. Most lawmakers do not have science or technical background. So those two items of truth should frighten you, because you have people setting national policy that involves a lot of technical detail, but that by people who don't have a lot of technical training in their background. And then, of course, we all know that Christians are needed in national and policy leadership to help set the tone and the priorities and so that we can have a country that's run by godly principles. So Christians with scientific background have gifts and insights, I believe, that are needed at all levels of scientific inquiry and practice, including science policy. Okay. Few members have the science or technical background. There's a couple of exceptions, more than a couple, but I wanted to mention two physicists. Rush Holt is a physicist from New Jersey who used to be the director, I believe, of Brookhaven National Labs, and he decided to go into public service as a representative. And it really is public service. I've watched these people in action, and, you know, in spite of the occasional crook that you hear about on Capitol Hill, there are many, many people there that are working very, very hard, and they left very nice careers and in quiet lives to go and do this as an act of service, and I've been humbled by seeing that. And of course, I want to mention Vernon Ehlers from Michigan, who is a member of ASA, and in fact, he's on the advisory board of ASA. And both of these two gentlemen are physicists by training and career. And there are also a few members scattered through the House and the Senate who have other technical backgrounds and other sciences in medicine. But other than that, it's pretty scarce to find somebody with a technical background. So these members of Congress depend on having an informed staff to guide them through. So how do you get people with science and technical backgrounds into the staff or the offices on Capitol Hill? And this goes for the agencies, the executive agencies, too. One way is fellowship programs that offer a path for people like us who may, you know, have been trained in an academic and scientific realm but wouldn't know how to operate in a political realm on our own. A fellowship program offers a path for scientists to enter the political and policy realm, to learn about it, and perhaps to stay. You have to learn a different language if you're going to make this transition. All right, I've just listed a few things. There's many, many things that values that are different, or ways of communication that are different when you contrast the scientific and academic realm that most of us are familiar with the way things are done in the political realm. In the scientific realm, what's most valued are brilliant insights, advancement of knowledge, and these lists, by the way, are not mutually exclusive. All of these things listed here are valued in both realms, but there's a different priority list. While the scientific realm would have these brilliant insights and knowledge advancements as the most valued, perhaps, the political realm, the most valued quality that people look for in an office of a member of Congress or the Senate is loyalty. They want to make sure that, you know, whether you're brilliant or not, that you're going to be loyal to the office. If you have great connections, people skills, networking, that is tops. You know, information can come later down the list. So, that's always a little shocking for a scientist to see. In the scientific realm, information is spread through talks like this and through published papers. In the political realm, the discourse happens through networks and brief conversations with people that you've, the old boy network, which is now growing to include a lot of girls too, okay, men and women, and knowing people is essential. People skills are essential in the political realm. I mean, what was one of the things as I was interviewing around the Hill, they want to know, not about this, resume of educational degrees, but, can you sit down with people and have a friendly conversation and have an exchange of what we want and what they want and briefly and to leave a good taste in everyone's mouth. So people skills are essential. People skills in the scientific realm are also very useful, but as many of you know, they're not always emphasized as the highest priority of skills. So, the list could go on and on, but there is a different lingo in the political realm that people from scientific backgrounds have to learn if they're going to be successful in operating there. One surprise for scientists is that decisions in the political realm are not always made based solely on truth and, gasp, gasp. Or maybe we could say, there are many levels of truth. And I like one example of the tobacco farmers of the eastern United States. If they have to make a decision about whether we should subsidize tobacco farms, if a scientist looks at that, most scientists would say, well, that's silly. We've found out that tobacco causes, public health problems, that then, so if you subsidize tobacco farming, then you end up with more, perhaps more use of tobacco, which creates more burden on the public health networks, and you need to, put more money into public health. So you're basically just, paying one group in order to end up paying another, and it just makes no sense. So of course you wouldn't subsidize tobacco farming. But that's not the only piece of information that a member of Congress has to deal with. if they don't subsidize a certain set of farming, they could end up with a high level of unemployment, a high level of suffering of the people of that district. So there, you know, there are many, many components to making a decision that well-meaning people in Congress have to deal with that scientists aren't used to having to deal with. Okay. So there's Vernon Ehler's office. If you're ever wandering around through the Longworth House office building, you can go to room 1714, and Mr. Ehlers will be happy to receive you, I'm sure, and say hello, especially if you say you're an ASA member. There's I went to talk with him, and the day I was there taking these pictures, I didn't end up taking one of him because he had just had a bit of minor skin surgery, and I didn't think he'd want his picture broadcast here on the talk. Okay. The Congressional Fellows Program was started about 30 years ago by the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the idea was to get more people with scientific background and expertise plugged in on Capitol Hill, not just to help with the overtly scientific issues, but also to advise on all these other issues I mentioned, you know, economics, agriculture, and so forth and so on. There are about 50 fellows each year. Many of these are congressional. Actually, my numbers may be a little off, but we're scientists, order of magnitude, okay, here. About 50 fellows. Most of these fellows have PhDs and are at various career stages. There are those who, many of whom have just come out of having a PhD. Some have had several years of postdoctoral experience like myself. And some, it's a lower number, but also represented are people at more senior stages of their career who are on a sabbatical year or maybe in their retirement and they have time. There's only a few stages in your career when you can take a break and do something like this. Different scientific societies will sponsor a fellow each year, such as the American Physical Society, which is my sponsor. The American Chemical Society is sponsoring a fellow each year, and I want to point them out specifically because there was a woman in our midst, I think she's gone today, but Emily Jarvis, who is here at our meeting, will be the American Chemical Society Congressional Fellow next year. So I am by no means the only one in our midst to do something like this. And Frances Collins' wife, I believe her name is Diane Baker, I'm not sure about that, she was a Congressional Fellow last year. So we know of in our midst of several people who have done this kind of thing. Congressional fellows go through an interview process to get chosen by their society, and then we're all sent to the AAAS to have 3 weeks of intense orientation, which is a great way to learn how to operate on Capitol Hill if you come from academia and have no idea how to do that. The congressional fellows then interview around on the House and the Senate side, different offices of members of the Senate or the House to try to find a good match. You also interview in committees. There are many committees, such as the Budget Committee, the Ag Committee, and the Science Committee, and try to find a good match of where you would like to work and which offices would like to have you. Okay. There are also, in addition to these congressional science fellowships, there are also science policy fellowships offered by the AAAS, in which you end up working in a federal agency, such as the National Science Foundation, EPA, USAID, State Department. There are diplomacy fellowships for people with technical backgrounds who want to work in diplomatic and international relations issues. These are fantastic opportunities for anybody in here who has this set of skills and desires to kind of get plugged in to national and international policy. All of these fellows, the congressional and the agency policy fellows, are then trained by the AAAS over a wonderful three-week orientation period, and we're kind of shepherded by them throughout the fellowship year. I'm telling you about this because many, many people want to know how in the world, you know, I'm kind of vaguely interested in policy issues, but I wouldn't have a clue as to how to learn about possibilities. So I'm telling you some of these possibilities. And you can find more by going to the AAAS website or by talking to people like me who've learned about these things. I did my interview process. I interviewed all over Capitol Hill, many senators, many House members, many committees, was getting very discouraged because I wasn't finding what seemed like a good match for my interests and skills. I looked for everything except science issues because I wanted to do something different. So I interviewed for doing things in human rights and other issues that I care about. But the best opportunity for me ended up in the Committee on Science on the House, doing no less than space science and astronomy issues, which is my background. So I tried to escape and I failed. Okay. The Science Committee is chaired by Sherwood Bollert of New York, upstate New York. The House of Representatives, right now the majority party is the Republican Party, the minority is the Democratic Party. The opposite is true on the Senate side at present. But Sherwood Bollert is a moderate Republican from upstate New York. The ranking minority member sitting to his right in this picture is Ralph Hall, a Democrat from Texas. They are very, both of these are wonderful gentlemen, very affable and it's humorous because they are so different from their party stereotypes. Mr. Bollert, the Republican, is a very pro-environment kind of guy who's very interested in federal funding for environmental programs and things that are sort of stereotypically not Republican. And Ralph Hall, the Democrat, loves the idea of drilling for more oil and drilling in he's from Texas. He likes the oil companies. He wants to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and he loves, you know, building. He thinks nuclear power plants should be abounding everywhere. So it's really funny to hear these two talk because they're so opposite from the stereotypes that we hear for these two parties. Our committee has a total of about 30 members from both sides of the aisle. And the House Science Committee has four subcommittees, the Subcommittee on Energy, the Subcommittee on Research, which the Research Subcommittee has jurisdiction over the National Science Foundation, the Subcommittee on Space and Aeronautics, which has jurisdiction and oversight responsibilities over NASA and FAA, parts of FAA, and the Subcommittee on Environment, Technology, and Standards. This subcommittee has jurisdiction over NIST, the National Institute of Standards. And Vernon Ehlers, who I will keep bringing up to you, is the chair of that Subcommittee on Environment, Technology, and Standards. I personally worked for two subcommittees, not that one, but the Subcommittee on Research and the Subcommittee on Space and Aeronautics. These subcommittees, or the House Science Committee in general, has jurisdiction and oversight over many agencies or pieces of agencies that have to do with research. Interestingly, and for reasons no one quite understands, the health-related sciences like NIH are not under the Science Committee jurisdiction. So they have another committee that is caring for them. So the committee staff consists of about 50 staff workers who actually do the work, because the members don't have time to think about the issues in depth. Think about that. The staff does all the work, and that includes right now three fellows like myself. The Republicans and Democrats get along well on the party. It's a very bipartisan committee. We have Ralph Hall and Sherwood Bollert again here at a reception in their honor, and they are both champions of each other. Okay. Here's some of the agencies that we do watch over carefully: Department of Commerce, NASA, as I said, FAA, some of NOAA, some of FEMA, the Emergency Management Agency, NSF, and part of DOE as well, and NIST. This is our hearing room, one of them, where we call in people to testify before Congress, and which means testifying before our committee if it's a science-related issue. So I've helped put together a few hearings, which has been an interesting experience. This is Jack Marburger, who's the president's science advisor. He is works in the president's Office of Science and Technology Policy, and he gets called in many times to testify before us. This is looking back the other direction in the hearing room, and around the wall you have portraits of the various chairmen. They've always been men so far, chairman of the Science Committee. And I don't know all of their names offhand, but I will show that there's a pioneering spirit in the Science Committee, because this one portrait, and I'm sorry, I need to find who this is. Maybe somebody in here knows, but But showing that pioneering spirit of reaching out to, you know, in our case, the western parts of our what is now our country, and also the regions of space. Okay. This is another hearing room that we have, and you can see the sort of visionary ethos of these committee rooms. Part of our oversight responsibilities are NASA. So this is the crew of the space shuttle that went to the Hubble Space Telescope for the most recent refurbishment of that telescope. And so they always come back and champion their accomplishments to our committee so that we can feel proud of our agency. This is another group of astronauts that went and spent 125 days on the space station, and they came back to be congratulated by our chairman, Mr. Bollard. All right, I want to move on now to a more sobering things. The Science Committee, by the way, is a pretty happy place to work. Usually we're working on interesting and uplifting things. But September 11th really cast a dark cloud, as we all know, over the whole world, and especially over our country, and especially on Capitol Hill. September 11th was a very bad day. And I, on September 11th, had just been working there for about a week and a half. I was in the middle of my orientation process. I was sitting in a building right there on Capitol Hill, the Madison Building of the Library of Congress. If any of you know where that is, it's just right across the street from the U.S. Capitol. We were in the middle of part of our orientation seminar, and we began getting these disturbing news reports. And, you know, it didn't take long after you heard that one tower of the World Trade Center had been hit, and then the second. And that was disturbing enough. But then they brought in the CNN monitor for us to watch. Then when the Pentagon was hit, doesn't take a brilliant mind to deduce that national, you know, big national buildings of pride are being targeted right now, and we don't know how many are still to come, and we are sitting next to one of the most important national buildings that we have. And so the question was, you know, should we stay inside? Should we walk around outside and get out? You know, can you get out of town? They closed down the trains. It was a difficult day. We didn't know what to do. One of my fellows and I didn't even know her very well, but she was terrified, and we went out on the sidewalk and prayed together for guidance as to what to do. We didn't know what to do. And God did protect us. You know, I sometimes think about that other plane that crashed in Pennsylvania. It might have come and hit us. So it was a very bad day, and these terrorist attacks, both by the airplane and the following anthrax invasion that we had on Capitol Hill, have had a major effect on Congress and thus all of the staff and thus fellows like myself as well. The first priority of Congress has turned to national security, homeland security. It's good to reflect, as I watch this going on and all the legislation and all the hearings suddenly focused on national protection, which I think is the right thing to do, but what do we as a nation gain and lose by shifting the bulk of our attention, both financial and thought process, to nervous self-protection? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do this. I think we should, but I do. It is a sadness to me that evil in the world causes us to kind of have to close our doors and look inward rather than looking outward, and I hope we don't get too caught up in this. All right, some of the issues, therefore, for our science committee have included development of this new Homeland Security Department. This new Homeland Security Department creates a new Undersecretary for Research and Development in our House bill. We added this to the president's proposal for this new department. Therefore, there would be someone who will watch over all the federal R&D that would go into this new Homeland Security Department. Cybersecurity is something that we push. This is a big loophole in our national security system is our computer networks. And so cybersecurity support has been increased by legislation that's come through our committee. We've thought about other homeland security issues such as pipelines, water security, looking for more domestic energy sources and so forth. But there are other things other than homeland security that we have been working on in the committee. One is looking at balance in the National Science Foundation funding as compared to funding for health and biological life sciences, such as is funded by the National Institutes of Health. We very much appreciate the National Institutes of Health, and they are on a doubling track in their funding, and our committee supports that. But we worry that the basic research that underlies a lot of the advances that we have in medicine and other fields, that basic physics and chemistry and basic research in biology even, is being somewhat shortchanged by this emphasis on results that everyone wants to see. And so one of our concerns has been to increase basic research also at the National Science Foundation, to put them also on a track of increase that would parallel the National Institutes of Health. Let me show you a little bit more graphically what this means. Over the past 30 years, I just put three areas of research here, and you can look at the funding in physical sciences and engineering, which has basically remained flat in constant dollars, versus federal funding for life sciences, most of this being applied medical research. And in some sense, we can rejoice that so much, you know, emphasis is being put on finding cures to diseases and advances in medical care, and I'm greatly appreciative to many of you out there who work in these fields. The concern is that if we overfund one level of science relative to basic research that supports it, for example, physics research is what has allowed many of the medical advances in laser surgeries and so forth, we would get ourselves in a bad national mess in the future by this unbalanced science program. So we're trying to lift up the physical and basic research along with the funding at NIH. We also are concerned with increasing math and science education in this country and improving it. That's been a problem to get the technical skills embedded into our students at an early age and get them to stay in the fields throughout college and graduate school. There are many, many other issues. I've just thought of a few to put down here. We've been supportive of plant genome research. We have also been concerned about invasive species. This is something that Vernon Ehlers, again, our ASA friend, is quite concerned about, is the presence of invasive species in our native lakes and forests. Whenever you accomplish something or pass a bill or introduce a bill, you, of course, want to broadcast it as much as possible. So every time a new piece of legislation is introduced by the Science Committee, there's a press conference out by the Capitol. So this again, is a bipartisan release. I think this probably has to do with our bill to increase funding for the National Science Foundation. So there's Sherwood Bollard up at the podium making the proud announcement. And then in the background, you see Nick Smith over on the left. Nick Smith is the chairman of the Subcommittee on Research. And then I don't know the other two gentlemen in the picture. I don't know who they are, but Eddie Bernice Johnson from Texas is there. She's very, very supportive also of science. She's a Democrat from a Texas district. All right, so then what do I do? I work on issues related to space science, earth science, physics, and astronomy. And so, therefore, I'm pointing you back at this NASA emblem there and the NSF emblem. Some of the issues that I face, people ask me, well, what do you do there? You know, what do you do? I work on issues such as cooperation of NASA and the National Science Foundation in astronomy and astrophysics. I helped write up a little clause in our NSF bill to get representatives from these two agencies to meet regularly to discuss cooperation in astronomy and astrophysics, since these two agencies have very, very closely related work but often don't communicate so well. I participate in oversight of NASA projects, especially space science and earth science projects. It's kind of scary, but I'm actually been put in sort of the chief position of oversight of all of NASA's science missions. Not space shuttle, not space station, but things like the Hubble Space Telescope, the Next Generation Space Telescope. This means watching to make sure the projects are progressing as they should. We meet with representatives of these agencies regularly. I look at issues like the effects of the international traffic and arms regulations. These are another national security regulations that are hampering science, in a sense, because it makes it difficult to collaborate with international partners, especially if you want to put up a satellite or something that has technology in it that's sensitive. The chairman of our Subcommittee on Space and Aeronautics is Dana Rohrabacher from California. He's very worried about near-Earth asteroids hitting us, so I've been charged with saving us from them. We are also concerned with how you balance the earth science funding that we need to understand global change, global climate change over the long period versus that same set of funding that could be used for near-term applications, looking at agriculture needs and short-term climate variability to help farmers and other planners make their plans. And there's always some tension there about, you know, that we get a lot of toys from the various agencies that we work with. I do some fun things. We had NASA come over and present to Congress staff the recent achievements of their Mars exploration program. So that's Jim Garvin on the left, who's the chief Mars scientist at NASA, and on the right is Orlando Figueroa, who's the program manager for the entire Mars exploration project at NASA. And that was a fun day. The Mars program is sending a mission up about every other year now for the next decade to learn more and more about Mars. I wanted to mention some things that disturb me as a Christian, but I think any person who has some interest in ethics, you know, there's a zillion things you could be concerned about what's going on the Hill. And so I've chosen a couple here. These are not issues that we dealt with in our science committee. These are issues that we have no jurisdiction over, so these are just personal things that have bothered me. And I just mention them as examples because there must be 1,000 more. But if a Christian is working on Capitol Hill, it's very important to have discernment. And it's hard when there are so many voices from so many directions giving a different spin on what is true. One is a sort of what I think is a misleading dialogue, if you could call it dialogue, on Capitol Hill that concerns the stem cell and the cloning research issues. I've sat in on several hearings and briefings. I'm sorry that I missed the session here that was on stem cell and cloning research. But I can tell you that I was disturbed by the way hearings are set up by pulling in witnesses who will all say the same thing. And I don't even know where I stand on this issue in some sense, whether there's some level of you know, therapeutic cloning, as they call it, that's okay. I know Christians who are on both sides of the issue. It's difficult. But without being able to articulate the viewpoint of the other side with integrity, that disturbs me, and that's very, very often a problem. I've never, for example, heard in the hearings and briefings by those who are supportive of the idea of therapeutic cloning research, they've never mentioned that there is, that the real problem that a lot of the public has is that you do have the equivalent, if you will, of a fertilized egg that's dividing and growing, that it, were it implanted, it would continue to grow. And for many people, that is a human life or close enough to it that it makes this research disturbing. Now, there's disagreement on what is human life and when does it begin. But to not be able to just make the statement of understanding as to why a lot of people in this country would have ethical concerns about stem cell and cloning, especially cloning research, that disturbs me. And on the other hand, I hear people talking about, you know, all cloning research as being useless and not really seeing some of the potential or at least being able to articulate it. And that's where I think scientists and Christians can come in to be sympathetic to other points of view, to understand them, to articulate them well, while at the same time moving towards some kind of a conclusion. Another totally different issue that disturbed me is massive pieces of legislation that go through with little amendments tacked on that nobody notices that are quite harmful. One is this massive farm bill that was passed this year. Many people, both Republicans and Democrats, supported it, and I think there must have been many good things in there to support our national agriculture policy. But if you look closely, you'll see some things that are, I think, disturbing for Christians. One is the sort of overt support for massive factory farming that pollutes the environment and produces waste in a way that's very hard for our environment to handle, and sort of rewards these large factory farming operations at the expense of the smaller family farms that may be more environmentally friendly. Animal welfare issues were basically mostly wiped out in the bill, and this was most disturbing to me because there were amendments passed by both the House and the Senate that were then in the conference committee that tries to reconcile these two bills were wiped out, even though there was no disagreement, one of them being on downed animals. What do you do with a cow that can't walk? Do you drag it around the slaughterhouse and force it to crawl around by electric prods so you can sell it? And one piece of legislation said, no, you have to sell it back on the farm and euthanize it humanely there. You can't transport it and do all this thing. This failed in the conference committee, even though it passed both houses. Things like this are disturbing to me. Another amendment wiped out 95% of research animals are no longer defined as animals under the Animal Welfare Act because of a little noticed amendment to this bill. Is it right for us to wipe out the definition of birds and rodents as animals just so that we don't have to protect them by federal protection? I don't think so, personally. And these things slip through, and I worry, as an example, that a lot of things are getting through. A Christian on the Hill, whether or not you agree or disagree with me on these particular issues, the point I'm trying to get across is that a Christian on the Hill can and should have discernment to watch these issues, to be able to make global decisions based on many factors that are hopefully ethically based and not just based on pleasing large funding constituents. All right, so I worry that these conference committees have too much power that's beyond constitutional powers. We need more Christians on the Hill. We need Christians with wisdom and education and compassion on the Hill. We need more Christians who are Democrats on the Hill, and we need more Christians who are Republicans on the Hill. And that may sound like a strange thing to say, but I believe that the Democratic Party has, you know, strengths in some areas that the Republicans do not, and likewise the Republicans have strengths in certain areas that the Democrats typically do not. But if you could have these issue areas on which these parties have their strengths and weaknesses, each of them informed by Christian viewpoints, I think it would be a great help to Congress. We need more experienced scientists in national leadership. A lot of these issues, I've seen it happen several times, an issue will come through an office, a member of Congress facing a certain issue that's very scientifically based, and they don't know who to turn to. So they turn to their 20-year-old staffer who's, you know, studying for to get ready to go to law school. And that staffer is a hardworking young person, but doesn't have, you know, years of scientific experience to really inform that member of Congress on the issue. And so if you have more experienced scientists in these roles, it benefits the nation, it benefits everyone. And if you put all these ideas together, it would be wonderful to have more Christian scientists in government, in public policy, because then you have some people who have background in the technical, the scientific expertise, who also have a sense of global stewardship ethics. I'm not saying that there are non-Christians there are plenty of people, Christian and non, who have, you know, the same sets of concern. But Christians have an explicit calling by our Lord to do everything for His glory. And I think that having more Christians with scientific background in government and public policy would be a great way to serve the Lord and to serve our country. Christians at least should have personal skills and sensitivities that are very helpful in the political realm. And I think that this kind of thing was mentioned by Ian Hutchinson yesterday. I discovered that just little skills that I pick up by being in evangelical circles and leading a small group or getting up and reading the scripture or something gives me skills at, you know, looking around the room and asking for input, asking for opinions, you know, making sure everyone feels included, being sensitive when someone's opinion is not being respected. These are kinds of things, skills that are not often well known on Capitol Hill, so it gives you a great boon if you sort of, you know, use the sensitivities and the respect for each person, you know, whether or not you agree with them, but respecting them as human beings made in God's image. These are things that can really help you in a political realm. Okay. I wanted to speak a little bit about Christian outreach in this environment. It's difficult because life on Capitol Hill is very fast-paced. It's very high stress. The hours are very long. A good day for me, a short day is 11 hours. A long day is 14. They're interesting hours, though. I mean, I love my job. So this is, you know, it's a toss-up. You know, why can't I have the job I love with the hours I'd prefer? You know, that's the issue. But But the intense pace, you know, there's meetings, you know, running around trying to get legislation through, meeting constant deadlines, it makes it hard to build relationships and have, you know, deep academic philosophic dialogue with anyone. But over time, you do form bonds. And the bonds are formed based on building trust. And this is, you know, probably true in many kinds of work environments, not just working on Capitol Hill. I have had some opportunities to share the love of Christ with my fellow staffers in my offices. I found many of them, as in any office that any of us work in, do have questions about their life, their future, their destiny, decisions, their personal life. I didn't realize that marriage was such an unusual idea until I worked in my office with good people that mostly are 30 in their 30-somethings in the science committee staff. And the majority of the staffers, and this is not to say that one lifestyle is, I mean, you know, this is not meant to be a judgment, it's an observation. The majority, or at least half of the staffers, are living with their partners to whom they are not married. They may plan to be married, they may not. Marriage is something that, you know, is not as expected anymore, and I didn't realize this coming out of Christian circles, you know, and yet many of these people are confused, you know, what is marriage all about? What do I found, you know, if I do get married to this person, what do I found it on? And I've been able to share a little bit about making decisions based on something else, based on obedience to Christ and loving Him and His love for us. And people have been very grateful when I would listen. You know, listening skills are so incredibly appreciated. I was able to talk to a member of Congress. I won't share his name, but I was going on a field trip to a local science facility with this member of Congress. And he's a member who holds many of what we many in the conservative church would consider, you know, correct Christian, Republican, you know, values. And he says, God bless you to everyone. You know, he hands it, God bless you, you know. And he has crosses in his office. And I discovered on talking with him that he really did not understand that Christianity was any different from any other religion, that, you know, they were all paths to truth. And I was able to share with him that I felt that there was great truth in many religions, but that there was something unique about Christianity, that Jesus did something for us, you know, that he didn't just teach us and lead us, he actually did something for us that we couldn't do ourselves. And this man was raised in a sort of, you know, fundamentalist Southern Baptist tradition, and yet he'd never heard that message. And so, and I, you know, that just astounds me. At the same time, you know, I've spoken with people who have a more liberal political perspective and who also, you know, knew something of Christian values, but didn't know the basic gospel. So it's just like anywhere else in our country, any other setting. Don't assume that somebody, no matter what they say or how they act, that they really understand the gospel. And in fact, I promised this congressman that I just spoke to you about that I would bring him something from this meeting. I told him I was going to this meeting. I explained it was a meeting of scientists who are Christians who are trying to, you know, think about the relationship of science and Christianity. And he said, oh, that sounds fascinating. And I promised him I would bring him something from this meeting for him to reflect on. And he said, don't bring a book. I don't have time to read a book. Bring a pamphlet. Bring something short. So that's the short attention span. So if you all can help me to think of something that's moving and that's short to give to this person, I'd appreciate it. Is there Christian fellowship on the Hill? Yes, there is. Members of the Senate and members of the House do have weekly prayer breakfasts and Bible studies. These are generally closed to anyone but the members so that they can feel free to express themselves without worrying about what will come out in the newspaper the next day. So Mr. Ehlers does attend as much as he can. He told me that there are about 45 people who attend these on the House side. On the Senate side, the Senate chaplain Ogilvie is very good about reaching out not only to the senators but also to the staff, because remember, there's probably over 10,000 staffers who work on Capitol Hill. So that's what's really running the country. If you want to be frightened, the average age of a staffer is about 23, 24, and these are the people that are writing the legislation and doing the work. So Senator Ogilvie leads the Bible studies for congressional staff every Friday, and they're wonderful, and I go as often as I can. There are outside groups that try to reach out to Congress and to congressional staff, and I don't know them all. I haven't had a chance to learn all these things, but there's something called the Christian Embassy. I don't know exactly what that's all about, but I think they sponsor Bible studies. There's something called Politics and Principle lecture series that's sponsored by a Center for Christian Statesmanship, which is a ministry of a conservative pastor in the South, D. James Kennedy Ministry, I think it's called. But I've gone to some of these talks. Joanne Davis is a representative from Virginia, for example, who gave a talk in this series about her faith and how it affects her work as a member of Congress. Okay, Vernon Ehlers, I went to visit him and to tell him about this meeting. He apologizes for not being here, but he sends his greetings and his love to all of you. And I asked him for, you know, advice that he could give for those of us in the audience, those of you who would like to be more involved in reaching out to the public. And, you know, without a question, he says, get involved, okay? Be salt and light. Don't pull back. Christians are needed out there. You know, vote. And if you vote, you've already done more than most people in the country. Vote in an educated way. Don't just walk in and punch holes that you don't know about. Be aware and educated on current issues, especially the science and technical background. You know, academics have the gift of being able to balance different points of view and understand them, and that's very useful. Ehlers' number one advice was to run for office. And, you know, that surprised me. I didn't think he'd say that, but that's absolutely his number one advice. He said, run for office. You know, run for the school board. Go for local office, state, national. That's what he did. He was a physics teacher, and he went around and ran for office. He didn't even have the support of the local Republican Party. He's a Republican, because he was too moderate in his views. And so he went and earned the votership on his own by going door to door and giving everyone a little tree to plant in their yard, and that was appreciated. So he encourages people to run for office, and if you can't run for office, to work on a campaign. So don't pull back from the political process. Get involved. And to pray for our leaders. They really need prayer. They so much don't have time enough to pray, but they need our prayers. And I needed to check with my historian friends before I say this, so this may be totally wrong, but I think that Vernon Ehlers told me that John Calvin served on city council while leading a church during his lifetime. If I'm wrong about that, I apologize, but I think that's something Ehlers said, that we can have models of great Christian leaders before us who worked in the public policy realm as well. This could be your office. This is a hallway of a chamber of one of the House office buildings, and each member has their own office with their own flags out in front. It could be you if you hear this call to run for office. Every one of us can also and should be seeking the Lord. This is a passage that my local family minister back in Arkansas preached on once that I've never forgotten. And although the original teaching here was meant for the people of Israel, the nation of Israel, I think we can adopt it as well as people under the new covenant. And God says, you know, when bad things happen, when difficult times come, maybe because of your own sin, he says, then, you know, if, here's a nice if-then statement for those of us who were brought up on Fortran computer languages and related ones. It's a simple if-then. I think God gave us this for the scientists that were to come. If my people, who are called by my name, that's us, will, four things, humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, those are our responsibilities. Humble ourselves, pray, seek God's face, and repent from things we know are wrong. Then, God says, I will hear from heaven, I will forgive their sin, and I will heal their land. We can all participate in this way of healing our land. This, again, is our hearing room. Back to the hearing room. I'm about to close here, but I wanted to show you a couple of quotes on the front. Well, before I go to that, I do want to mention that there are people in our midst who are already working in the policy realm as full-time hard workers. I think of Susan Daniels, who's working at NIH. As I mentioned, we have a fellow in our midst who's going to be, or a person in our midst who will be a fellow next year. I'm sure there are many others of you working at NIH, working or making, maybe taking short-term stints at these agencies to be program managers and on review panels, and this is a much appreciated way of participating. The final thing I want to show you are quotes in the front of our hearing room. One is by Tennyson, where he says, "For I dipped into the future as far as human eyes could see, saw the vision of the world and all the wonder that would be." And I believe that as scientists, we should have that sort of imaginative and uplifting view of the good things that science can do. And that's the quote I see in the front of the science hearing room every day that I'm in there. And the other quote that's on the board in the front of everyone's eyes is this proverb, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." Thank you very much.